It is a great evening. Pardon my setting the water there, but I'm just kind of getting through a cold and a respiratory problem, so I know I'll need a drink of water before I get through the evening. But not only is it a great time in America, in rural America, it's a distinct pleasure to be with all of you again today. I reflected on this opportunity when it was offered up to me again, realizing that this is two in a row that I've had the opportunity to be the opening speaker. I was with you in 2006 in St. Louis, and I'm very gratified for the opportunity to be back again. You know, there's a marketing slogan, and I don't know who originated, but it goes something like 50 is the new 30. I kind of like that. Having reached an age at which I prefer to believe particularly that that's true, and I'm beginning to find that there are a lot of advantages in seniority. Getting old isn't all bad, really. But one of those advantages is perspective. And in perspective, I think it's important to reflect that what you're doing here this week and what you within the National Corn Growers Association have been doing for many years is immensely important. It really is. I can't understate it. I thought about this, and I don't really know how to say this without sounding somewhat like a melancholy, pandering, old over-the-hill farmer or bureaucrat, but in all seriousness, NCGA is truly to be commended. And I say this as a lifelong farmer, a lifelong member and former officer of the NCGA. NCGA, quite frankly, is to be commended for its continual far-sighted commitment to basic science, to genetics, to aggressive product and market development, and to the recognition that the carbohydrate economy is literally only limited by our imagination. Your commitment to trade and to policies based on science and intellectual honesty are really quite remarkable. And all of this is really reflective of nothing other than true leadership. So before I go any further, I really think that you ought to all give yourself a round of applause for the leadership that you provide. Please do it. You know, we all collectively know that there is an agricultural and economic revolution underway, not just in this country, but in the world. The general public thinks of this in terms of feeding a hungry world, and it truly is, of course, that. But it is, in my view, much more as well, because as the trinity of food, feed, and fiber expands to food, feed, fiber, fuel, and feedstocks, this is what's going on. The revolution in agriculture is, in fact, being driven in part by a parallel revolution in energy, in a new world in which calories and BTUs have now become fungible. We're in the very early stages of this process. Even though many of us have been involved in this for 30 years, we're still at the front end of this process. And the end is clearly not in sight, because we simply can't predict what this is going to look like and where we will be in 10 or 20, and certainly not in 30 years as I reflect back on the last 30 years. But what I do know is this, that NCGA is well ahead not only of the general public and most producer groups, but also most policymakers in understanding the potential and organizing in a way that allows you to aggressively pursue it. There are no guarantees. We all know that. No one, though, ever won the game if they didn't compete. And no one competes effectively unless and until he sees an opportunity and recognizes the competition. And you have clearly done that. NCGA is ahead of the curve, and that bodes well not only for corn farmers in American agriculture, but for the nation, and I would submit for the world as a whole. Because there is no field of endeavor more important today than meeting the demands of a growing world economy, for affordable food, for affordable fuel, as well as affordable feedstocks across an ever-growing spectrum of product lines. So again, thank you. Thank you for what you're doing, and I urge you to continually keep it up and keep the pressure on. Now, there are a great many things that I might discuss today. But there is one, in my view, which clearly overshadows all the rest. And that is the emergence of ethanol, a potentially very disruptive technology that is clearly now going mainstream. I should add parenthetically that I don't mean to slight biodiesel, which deserves a day of its own. But we're here today to talk about corn, and I'll focus this evening on ethanol. You know, ethanol production last year represented about 4% of global gasoline consumption. Over 90% of that total was produced in Brazil from sugarcane, and more importantly in the United States, and mostly from corn. Whether you regard 4% as a large number, I'll leave that up to you, but I in fact do view it as a very substantial number given from whence we started. But I would remind you, and I know that you all know this, that prices are set at the margins. In world demand for oil is surging. Supplies of conventional oil are not keeping up with demand. T. Boone Pickens the other day on CNBC said, we can produce 85 million barrels of oil a day. We need 87. We're not getting above 85 million. And in any event, and as a result of all of this, oil prices have marched inexorably from less than $15 a barrel less than a decade ago to more than $130 a barrel just in the recent few days. Now, I'm not a peak oil theorist, but peak oil or not, it is clear that we are getting a very painful demonstration of what happens when growing demand hits a constrained supply curve. You know, ethanol is not a complete answer to $4 gasoline, but it clearly is part of the answer. Ethanol last year accounted for more than 100% of the increase in U.S. gasoline consumption, and it is clearly gaining market share. And as a nation, we have not built a new petroleum refinery in more than 30 years. You all know those numbers. We have now clearly built 147 ethanol biorefineries that are already up and in operation. There are another 55 under construction and many more on the drawing board. Last year, we produced 6.5 billion gallons of ethanol, a fourfold increase since 2000. The new renewable fuel standard calls for 36 billion gallons by 2022, 15 billion gallons of it from corn, the rest from second-generation feedstocks. And that implies at least 20% of our fuel supply, exclusive of diesel, will be ethanol in less than 15 years. That is a significant play in anyone's book. And parenthetically and anecdotally, it's important to recognize that 36 billion gallons equates to 1 billion barrels of imported crude oil. 1 billion barrels of imported crude oil today is $130 billion, $50 billion more, approximately, the net farm income, and that is all rural in origin. Now, I'm told by many economists that it's a very difficult modeling question, that of figuring out how much ethanol has constrained gasoline price increases. And the estimates vary, but as you all know, they are substantial. Now, this particular fact is not being widely reported because oil and gasoline prices are rising anyhow, but without question, gasoline is less expensive than it would have been otherwise. The effect is there. The effect is there, whether it is reported or not, and it will grow as market share increases, without a doubt. Now, one would think that these contributions by ethanol to the nation would be celebrated. And in some places, such as here, they are. But we tend to live in a world, as you all know, in which no good deed goes unpunished. And the build-out of ethanol is clearly no exception. In recent weeks, we have seen a substantial assault on biofuels, generally, and ethanol in particular, centered on the food, quote, versus fuel controversial issue. We now know that what was only rumored literally a couple of months ago, that much of this assault has clearly been orchestrated by a slick professional PR campaign funded by the Grocery Manufacturers Association and possibly some ancillary sources. Now, clearly, in my mind, the source really doesn't matter because very clearly this attack has fallen on fertile ground. The anti-ethanol talking points have been picked up hook, line, and sinker by several of the major media organizations. And, unfortunately, some of the media have presented the public with a highly sensationalized, one-sided, and frequently very inaccurate account of a very complicated and enormously important question that is both, in my view, very unfortunate, and it is destructive, and I resent it, not only as a farmer, but also as a policy person. Now, I'm sure that all of you are well aware of this debate. I'm not bringing you any new news. And I'm confident that most of you are now aware, I hope you are, aware that USDA and Secretary Schaefer have joined this discussion in a very formal way. If you've not already had the opportunity to, I urge you to review Secretary Schaefer's May 19th press conference, which is on our website. I suspect it may have been picked up by some others. But later this week, actually today, he is involved in attending the UN's FAO food conference in Rome. And he is again going to be focusing on clarifying a number of these economic issues and misstatements. And I believe this will be helpful. Yes, we acknowledge USDA is a big, cumbersome, and sometimes bureaucratic organization. But we aren't as quick as some of the entities that feel free to run with back-of-the-envelope calculations. We tend to try to fact-check things and have our economists run the numbers before we go to print and maybe, in fact, verify them against other third-party sources. Or, frankly, if we didn't, we could go, much like our prognosticators do on business talk shows like CNBC, and make any kind of a statement that we wished. Now, that, of course, still doesn't mean that we're always right, but it does mean that we try to be careful. We tend to try to back things up. And all of this means that we sometimes we find ourselves playing catch-up. Now, our hope, however, is that if we can lower the tone, deflate some of the sensationalized claims, encourage a somber second look, and believe that if we do this, eventually this good data will prevail. That's leadership. And that's what, in my view, this administration has tried to provide on this issue, not just now, but from the time we released the May 2001 energy policy statement that was presented by President Bush at that time. That at least is our hope. Whether we will in fact see sober second look stories from drive-by artists in the media clearly remains to be seen. But that is our hope. Now, we would also hope that the critics would at least consider that this should be a discussion about food and fuel, not food versus fuel. And I know that you agree. You know, biofuels and beyond biofuels, a whole new world of bio-based products derived from agriculture and forest feedstocks is an incredible historic opportunity and one that, in my view, is certainly worth exploring. And we would hope that these critics, in their rush for today's sensationalized headline, would not forget yesterday and last week's and last month's headline. Food and fuel are clearly not the only issues on the table. Because if we're serious about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, biofuels are a critically important part of the solution. There simply today is no other fuel source available immediately or in the near term that can displace significant amounts of fossil fuels in transportation. That's a fact. Someday, hydrogen fuel cells or improved batteries are going to facilitate this job. But that day clearly is not yet here. Now, we would hope that the critics would take time to remember that the vital national security and economic security imperatives of diversifying away from oil. And what does it mean? This has been a priority for President Bush from the very beginning. It remains a priority, and ethanol, as we build out to this 36 billion gallon renewable fuel mandate, is a core part of that strategy. And it will have significant economic benefits, not just for rural America, but for the country as a whole. And perhaps more important, we would hope that the critics would take a second and a third and a fourth look at the numbers to get them right. You know, it's true that global food commodities have increased. Without question, That's painful. We all know that. Since mid-1999 through March of 2008, global food commodity prices have risen 98%. But in that same period, the index for all commodities, non-food as well as food, have risen 286%. The index for crude oil, interestingly enough, for that same period of time, has risen 547%. In the world of commodities, food price inflation trails the broader averages. It has. You as farmers know this. It still does, and it probably always will. Let's not lose sight of that fact. It is also important to note that these are indices for raw commodities, not consumer prices. In the United States, farm commodity prices account for slightly less than 20% of the consumer food dollar. The bulk of the price paid at the checkout counter by consumers and the bulk of the increase consumers have recently seen are driven by other factors, including, and especially, including the rising cost of energy. So for all the dire headlines, the fact is that the food prices in the United States last year rose 4.5%. And according to the White House, and that was opposed to a historic long-run average over the last 20 to 25 years or something in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5%. But I also want to remind you that from 1980 to 2005, those price increases were incapable of driving the kind of investment into the commodity infrastructure necessary not just to produce food, but steel, cement, oil, and a whole host of other things. But that 4.5% increase, according to the White House Council of Economic Advisers, would have only been 4.25% if we'd had no ethanol production at all. In other words, ethanol production was responsible for 0.25 or 0.25% of the 4.5% increase. Globally, the Council of Economic Advisers estimates that worldwide demand for biofuels and feedstocks accounts for about 3% of the 43% rise in food prices over the last year. And our economists internally and a number of other studies that we've seen all collectively come up with a number in very much that same range. Now, having said all of that, I want to avoid myself falling into a trap of offering a single factor explanation for what is going on. Because, to repeat, many things are in play. And I would urge you at this conference to remember that there is an inelasticity to these sorts of inventory issues that we're dealing with. And we are going to need to be prepared, if in fact we have a short crop for the next couple of 3 years, to deal with some very difficult publicity. But I also urge you to remember one thing. In the early 1970s, we went through a very similar situation, precipitated by something that those of us that remember it called the Great Russian Grain Robbery. The Great Russian Grain Robbery essentially took dollar corn in 1969, or actually 90-cent corn from where I was at, and drove it to about $3.50 a bushel before, when the whole thing flattened out, it leveled off at about $2 a bushel, where it stayed pretty much from that period until the early 2000s. The interesting thing back then, we made some very, very dumb policy moves. What we in fact did was we got concerned that we weren't going to have enough energy, we weren't going to have enough food, we imposed wage and price freezes, we imposed export embargoes, and that precipitated and was one of a number of things that precipitated a long-term substantial decrease in the price of agricultural commodities, energy commodities, and a host of other things. I think it's important that we remember that, because that was poor policy. Now, in closing, though, another thing that I would like to draw your attention and one that to excuse me, to one aspect of this discussion that in my view is widely overlooked and that I submit is a very decisive part of this issue. And if we ignore this, we apt to get things backwards. We really do, and I believe many people are in fact doing that. The food and fuel discussion actually tends to begin with the observation that prices of both are rising. We know that. That's clear. That's true. But in the long run, The prices of both are rising for a simple fundamental reason, and that's rising demand. Fundamentally, rising demand is a good thing. It means that more people have more money to spend. It's a sign of economic growth. It signals opportunity. It is a signal to producers to respond. It's a signal to innovators to innovate. It's a signal to investors to invest. Now, fundamentally, the across-the-board revaluation of commodities that is occurring today in world markets is literally nothing other than a result of a robust, growing world economy. And in my view, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. This is a success story. And in my view, this cannot be overemphasized. And the question is why? And it's very simple. This is the price. This is the price we're paying for having won the Cold War. We won the Cold War. And since the fall of the Berlin Wall, we unleashed essentially almost 3 billion people who have collectively joined the world market system. Many of them are becoming formidable competitors. Many are, in fact, succeeding our furthest expectations of just a few years ago. And in my view, it's a great risk that we begrudge them these successes. On the contrary, we should figure out how to make them our customers and to work with them in a collaborative and a global market. Hundreds of millions of people are now joining the global middle class. Does this change the pricing of commodities? Of course it does. Do these changes inconvenience some sectors whose balance sheets may be misplaced at the particular time, who have to adopt to these new price regimens? Of course it does. Is this process of adaptation sometimes painful? Of course it is. How many painful adaptations haven't you as producers had to go through over the last 30 years? But in the end, once again, economic growth is a good thing, not a bad thing. Hundreds of millions of people are eating better, and they're graduating from bicycles and buses when their tummies gets full to automobiles. That's a good thing. New markets for producers both in the United States and abroad are a good thing. So in the end, in my view, despite these transitional turbulence, this is an extraordinary opportunity. We have faced technology revolutions and shifts in our resource base before. In each instance, we have overcome the transitional issues and emerged a stronger, more productive, and a more prosperous America. And I would submit the same can be true in a world that adheres to good governance and open markets. If we let markets work their magic, we have done it before. We can do it again. And as we begin to build the carbohydrate economy, I think this is what we need to keep our focus on. So let me conclude where I began. What you are doing here is extraordinarily important. You're helping to create a new resource base for a growing world. I clearly don't know what the future holds for corn or for any other commodity, but I'm very optimistic about it. And there are definitely going to be some surprises. You're going to have to keep your policy hats at their very, very top and tip-top and best. You are going to be confronted with some challenges in the next 2 to 3 years. But I do recognize that you have positioned yourself to explore the possibilities and to seize the opportunities before, and you are doing so again. That's all anyone can do. That's all any of you can do. And we at USDA, and myself in particular, are proud to be your partners in this effort. Thank you. Thank you all very much for asking me to join you. And I am immensely proud of what you've all done. Thanks again.